We're going to start today's session with a long-term colleague of mine from the industry, Raju Reddy, who has been both a CEO as well as investor. And he has particular perspective to bring to this conversation, and I'm very sure you will learn a lot from the conversation. So let's get started. Raju, welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning, Shamana. Thank you. Glad to be here.
So Raju, I want to start in an area which you spent a lot of years of your life in, which is dramatically changing with the advent of AI, which is the services industry. So whether it is IT services or outsourced services seems to be poised for a major refurbishing with the advent of AI. How do you view this opportunity?
Well, to begin with, I don't think we have seen a disruption, whether it is services or products, as big as what AI has been doing since the advent of internet, I would say, right? We've had many other technology shifts, whether it is cloud, mobile, many of them have had a huge impact on the industry, but nothing like what internet has done, and likewise today with AI. And so I spend significant amount of my time now investing in seed stage startups. Most of them are in the product space, but there are a few that are still in services. Increasingly, I think the sort of the borderline between what you would call a product offering versus a pure services model has been sort of shifting or even fading over the last 10 years, even before AI, right? And now with the advent of AI, I do see that I think there is a significant need for what you would call a human in the loop, kind of the human in the loop services. And there are a bunch of sort of new age companies that are coming into play, a few that I'm involved with directly, like Cognita. I don't know if you heard about that, or Critical River, that are purely traditional services companies, but much more led with some sort of a core IP based service offerings. But yeah, once again, I think there's also a shift in how the products and services are sort of starting to overlap in many of these cases.
Yes, so I think your point is exactly right. We are seeing human-centric AI, which means human needs to be in the loop using that AI, and it's giving rise to a few different kinds of business models that are a bit of an evolution from where we were earlier. And one that is coming up a lot is, with software as a service and the whole cloud movement, we went to a do-it-yourself model. Companies are selling software products as, software as a service, but it's really products. And then you expect the clients, the B2B clients, to be doing whatever they want to do by themselves. But now with AI, this model is shifting a little bit to do it for me also. So human in the loop can go in two different directions. Either it's human in the loop in the client's shop, or it's human in the loop in the vendor's shop where it is do it for me model. So there is a, whatever is the IP underneath, there is a human who's sitting there and using that IP and delivering the value as a do it for me model. And in some cases, it's the human is sitting inside the customer's shop and using the product and delivering the value.
I think the one segment of the services industry that is probably right in the middle of a huge transition is really the BPO industry. And that, frankly, I think most of us don't yet know how disruptive it's going to be just in terms of there are millions of people employed in the BPO industry today. So, you know, it's arguable whether you need as many people now going forward. It's almost certain you don't need as many. But the question is, you know, what fraction of that do you need in the future of BPO industry, say 5 years from now? What does the BPO industry look like? I think that's, you know, a fundamental question that I think many of these companies, you know, in the BPO kind of loosely called KPO, you know, that segment of the industry are, you know, trying to figure out. Yeah. But, you know, like anything, there are always newer opportunities and, you know, so.
Software development is getting hugely streamlined, right? The co-pilots are becoming extremely effective, so you don't need as many people on the software services side as well. And there are a lot of co-pilot products that are getting sold into that business. So there's a whole market emerging out of efficiency in the software development ecosystem. So let's talk a little bit about these companies that you mentioned to as use cases and case studies of what you're investing in. Cognita and Critical River are two that you just mentioned. Could you talk to us about what these companies are doing and how these models are playing into their situations?
These are more, you know, services led companies, but purely on the product side too, and that are much more AI first kind of companies that I'm involved with, and some of that is on my is in public information. You know, the companies that I'm on the board of called SciSpace, for example, that's much more in you know accelerating research. Think of it as a much more modern version of Google Scholar that is getting very solid traction. You know, we started monetizing just in October of 23, and we're at about 5 times where we plan to be by end of 24, right? And it has well over 7 million, you know, users today. And just in the last 28 days, we've added, you know, a couple million new users to that. So this is, so I think the takeoff and the traction is very real when you have a product that the market is looking for. I mean, I can go into, you know, each of these in more detail if necessary, but so SciSpace is a fantastic example of that.
So can you talk more about SciSpace, Raju? What's what is the audience? Is it researchers in universities, in academia? What is the audience?
Yes. Anybody who's doing research, publishing papers, or, you know, really analyzing research papers to make their, you know, decisions, right? So this could be in academia, certainly is a big part of it, but it could also be in the corporate world, like in the pharma, healthcare sector and all of that, right? There's a lot of the research labs, you know, in the world, outside of what you would call normally just universities.
Sure.
And so they're all the, you know, customers for SciSpace. And you can look it up, SCI Space. It's all one word. It's a company, you know, started well before Gen AI, specifically ChatGPT, came into marketplace. More around ML is how they started building it. And, you know, but they certainly got a great tailwind here with, you know, Gen AI becoming more commonplace now, and with all the models becoming much richer. So they're able to deliver a much higher value, you know, sort of research capabilities, both for publishing research papers, but also doing, you know, deep research analysis on any topic that typically a research lab might be dealing with. Yeah.
Interesting. And you quoted some very big numbers in terms of customer addition. In 28 days, 2 million customers added.
2 million users.
Users, okay.
Out of that, a fraction of them are paying customers, but yeah.
How are people finding this? Is it all people are just finding through word of mouth?
It's been mostly that. That's the interesting thing, Ramana. I mean, we haven't even started spending any marketing dollars. And So it's been largely word of mouth and quite a bit on Twitter. I didn't know that, but I didn't know these scientists hang out on Twitter, but they do, or at least they, sort of get the feed from that, and So, but yeah, it's been largely word of mouth, and yeah, it's just been phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else have you invested in that is interesting? This is very interesting. What you just described is very interesting.
Well,
Tell
there are a few other companies. There's one called Flam, which is again, this is all public information. So actually, Google used them for, it's basically in the advertising space. So it brings your print ads to life. So when you sort of take your camera and it's mixed reality, but again, there's a lot of AI within that. This is not necessarily Gen AI, but AI. And so again, this is a company that's really caught on fire, just in terms of how it's sort of disrupting the advertising industry. Typically, print ads are sort of, it's a dwindling market, but now, just by taking your phone and pointing to the QR code, which is like a specific a thing that's coded in there, on the in a print ad, the video starts playing within that frame. So Samsung recently introduced a feature called Circle to Search, along with Google, and so they used Flamp for that, and se several large sort of enterprises have been using that. This is, yeah, the product came into market about an year ago, and yeah, the company is doing extremely well. And again, these are all young first-time entrepreneurs, whether it's iSpace or Flam. Now, one of the areas that I'm sort of spending more time now is looking at companies, not just at the application level, but really as more of these AI apps become a big part of the economy, in the tech industry. I believe on the infrastructure side, it's going to put a lot of strain or demand thereby, for better performance, better reliability, security, and things like that. So there is a company that's kind of in stealth mode, called Akash X, started by a bunch of these sort of tech wizards, I like to think of them, coming from the database world, that are building this. Essentially, all your LLMs, LLM queries, the underlying layer, it translates into a bunch of SQL queries. So how do you execute those SQL queries much faster and with a higher reliability is kind of what that's the problem that they're solving. But my point is, as a lot of founders, entrepreneurs are looking at how can I use AI for a certain kind of business problem or whatever, I personally think there are going to be a lot of opportunities at the infrastructure level, at the infrastructure layer, given the sort of demands that these AI apps are going to put on the infra.
We've had several discussions on AI-enabled drug discovery in towards the end of last year, and we have covered AI-enabled drug discovery on our blog quite extensively. It's an
Okay.
area that I think is super exciting and super promising. Now, what the conclusion that was coming out of those discussions was that for AI-enabled drug discovery, you need basically, the platforms that are out there, like AtomWise, for example, are selling only to the large pharmas. So if you're a researcher at a university or inside of a, or if you're trying to do a startup in a in drug discovery, you don't really have access to the infrastructure that you need to be able to, develop your products. But I think DeepSeek changes a lot of that
Yes.
assumption, and DeepSeek is going to spawn a lot of infrastructure layer innovation.
Yeah.
I think somewhere the fusion between pure infrastructure layer as well as domain specific models, that combination is also going to create a platform layer that is going to be really interesting in terms of enabling a lot of innovation at those levels as well. So for example, if you combine a DeepSeek or comparable efficient model, train it in the pharmaceutical industry kind of data, and that's something that startups use to come up with new drugs based on their areas of expertise, that would be one of the ways to unlock drug discovery as a startup exercise, as opposed to just happening inside of pharmaceuticals.
Yeah. No, actually, you bring up a great point. The way I think about that, Sramana, is, you know, when we say researcher, right, normally we tend to think of somebody who's got a PhD degree sitting in a lab working on. So that may be, I don't know, 5 million people in the world or 10 million at the most. But, you know, there are probably 100 million people who, you know, are absolutely, you know, have that capacity without necessarily a PhD, but more importantly, have that inquisitive mind on sort of, you know, wanting to learn and, you know, sort of explore specific topics. And that's really what these tools like Sciespace do, right? It now allows many more of these sort of inquisitive minds around the world to, you know, essentially accomplish what a researcher in a lab might be able to do because of these sort of tools and all of that. Actually, as I was talking about it, I remembered, you know, several years ago, there was an XPRIZE competition for, you know, I think this was after the Exxon, you know, oil spill accident, sort of how do you clean up the, you know, oil damage in the ocean and all of that. And so one of the top three, you know, contestants, they didn't win the final prize, but they were one of the top three. Interestingly, it came from a tattoo parlor in Las Vegas, right? So these are not scientists, obviously, but, you know, they had that inquisitive mind. They had some knowledge of, I guess, how tattoos are removed or placed or whatever. So that's to me sort of a, you know, real example of what
innovation comes from. And I think
exactly. And these are the tools that make that possible, right?
Yes. So there is an incredibly exciting improvement in tools and infrastructure, and there's a lot of entrepreneurship going on and innovation going on in both of those, and especially the DeepSeek moment is driving efficiency into the system. That's number one. Number two, to me, that is really exciting is domain knowledge, right? There is a lot of domain knowledge in a lot of places. So if people can have access to infrastructure and don't need to be in a large company to have access to infrastructure, if they can have access to efficient infrastructure, they can apply their domain knowledge and start entrepreneurial ventures in a very scrappy, bootstrap manner. That is extremely exciting for me.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. So a lot of times when, you know, entrepreneurs come to me with their pitch on saying, oh, this AI, this thing, AI that, you know, I mean, that was okay. I would say maybe year or year and a half ago. But, you know, today it's like saying, well, I'm writing computer software, right? I mean, AI is such an integral part of it. So what really separates you from any other entrepreneur, you know, having that understanding of the domain and, you know, the business problem and if and how well you're solving that, right? So just saying I'm using AI to solve the problem is, you know, no longer a meaningful differentiator.
Yeah. The other really interesting area where we started this conversation that I also find very promising is that, you know, there are a lot of services companies out there, and there's so much AI technology right now to make services efficient. You almost can productize your services. You know, if you have a set of, if you have 100 clients that you're providing services to, you should be able to use AI to dramatically get margin out of those businesses.
Yeah.
Which is another interesting, you know, development for bootstrapped entrepreneurship in particular. And as you know, we support bootstrapped entrepreneurship very, very seriously. We have companies in the program right now, that's in the area of, as you said, advertising, marketing, social media marketing kind of stuff. There is a lot going on in those areas that where inserting AI into the models can really gain efficiency. And, you know, when you were doing your services company,
yes,
people considered services companies not really venture fundable until they reached very high levels of revenues, right? Your company, Persistent, Anand Deshpande,
yeah,
you guys raised venture capital, but it was much later in the game.
Yep, yep, absolutely, yeah, yeah.
But I think
I mean, that was 20 years ago, but yeah.
That was 20 years ago. But today, I think some of these services companies, because of this human in the loop, because of this ability to get so much more margin and so much more repeatability out of these ventures,
yeah,
some of these companies are going to become venture fundable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's definitely happening. I mean, Cognita, it's public information. They just raised $15 million from Nexus and others. Yeah, yeah.
What does Cognita do? Could you discuss?
Cognita, I mean, it started as sort of an AI-first MLOps company about 3 years ago. And this is all my ex-Air Atlantic guys. And some of them went on to become senior executives at Hitachi and all of that. And so they came together a little bit like the Mindtree team that came out of Wipro. And, you know, about seven of them, I think seven or eight of them in Cognita that started about 3 years ago and doing extremely well, again, with exactly like what you said, sort of IP-led services. And they have a product called Zuno that they use, but they are fundamentally a services company.
Yeah.
To deliver these, you know, solutions in the enterprise space. And yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at, there are two companies that are on my radar. Of course, Palantir is a services company, fundamentally a services company, IP-led services companies. That is a great example of an incredibly highly valued company.
Yes, yes.
A company that I don't know if you're monitoring it called Machinify. That's
Machinify.
Been around for a little while.
I see. Okay.
It just merged with two other companies. It's like a bit of a roll-up, AI services, IP-led services in the healthcare space, health insurance space.
Okay, I'll look it up. I know of Mu Sigma, Fractal. There are a few like that that have reached good scale.
Yeah, Shinify, the combined, the three company combined roll-up is $500 million ARR.
I see. Very nice. Very nice.
So. Yeah. So they,
and they probably have gross margins, you know, much higher than traditional service companies, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Because in the end, you know, all of these, you can say IP-led and all of that, but unless it reflects in your gross margins, you know,
right,
it's not a sort of a proven model yet. But all of these, I mean, look at Palantir, very, very high,
very
gross
high
margins.
Gross margin, and, yeah. The main objection to services companies from the venture capital world was one, gross margin, and two, repeatability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can crack those two nuts, then you have a venture fundable high scale company within the services model as well.
Yeah, yeah.
What else are you looking at, thinking about, interested in investing in terms of AI companies? What are you looking for example, if you, I mean, if
yeah.
something.
Yeah.
Come to you that you would like to invest in.
Yeah, so for me, Sramana, it's, you know, pretty much all my investments have been at a very early seed stage. And many of them, actually, it was even the first check that I wrote, right, that the founder raised. Over the last 3 years, you know, earlier I used to do this as an individual angel. But over the last three and a half years now, I do that with a couple of people that I've, you know, great friends, and I love working with them. Great respect for Kanwal Reki, who you probably know about anyway. He's a legend in the valley. And other person is B.V. Jagdish, who is also very well known. And then there's an operating partner, my name Rajan. So four of us have been investing in the name of what's called SVQ, Silicon Valley Quad.
Mm-hmm.
So we typically invest like $2 to $2.5 million, two to three mil as a seed stage. And again, nothing has really changed, whether it is AI or whatever, in terms of sort of philosophy of how I look at, startups that I invest in. It's always a bet on the people, the founder and his or her sort of leadership team, right? Now, clearly, you want to go after a market that's large enough. As I mentioned, if somebody comes to me with too much of sort of this AI, then I'm a bit more skeptical. This is not to say I won't invest in that, but, if they talk to me more about sort of the business problems and, one of the things I look for is sort of answer to two questions, right? Why you and why now? What is it about your background that gives you unique insight into understanding this problem?
Domain knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so sometimes it's understanding the problem, and sometimes it may be, maybe the problem is widely known, but you have a certain insight into addressing that problem that others won't, right? And that typically comes from having been, that's why you see a lot of, very successful companies come out by, founders coming from a large company like Google or Oracle or, VMware or whatever, right? Because unless you're at one of those places, you are unlikely to have seen that problem, And I'm not saying it's a necessary condition, not at all, but that's one of the reasons why. So why you, that's part of it. The other is why now? So what's happening in the industry that makes, this, the need for this a problem so compelling, right? For instance, like when I talked about the AI, the infra required to support all these AI explosion, to me, I think that's very real. Now within that, of course, there are various layers of whether it is security, speed or whatever, performance and all of that, but or storage. So there you have, different entrepreneurs. So the philosophy of sort of how and why I invest in a startup has really not changed. But AI is, of course, almost like, as I said, just an integral part of any product idea people are working on. Yeah. And now it'll be interesting to see with the announcement yesterday of quantum computing by Microsoft.
Yes.
What that does. And when you combine quantum computing capabilities with AI, and it's mind-boggling,
Where are we going? Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Super.
Both good and bad, by the way. I mean, there is also the, even with AI, it's tough enough with, all the ways that it can harm the...
Yeah, I think both the combination of AI and quantum computing is a tremendous threat for cybersecurity as well.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Anything can be cracked, basically. In the hands of the bad actors, anything can be cracked.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very dangerous thing
also. Yeah.
Well, wonderful.